From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
You may remember that in last year's senatorial race in the state of Maryland, the Democratic political establishment in that state seems to have all rallied around Congressman Chris Van Hollen. And then at some point, Congresswoman Donna Brazile says, wait a minute, I want to get into this race. And she did. And ultimately, she, however, lost. But is it conceivable to say that we're looking at a similar situation in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Yes.
Where the establishment...
There was a candidate for governor in Maryland in 2014, Anthony Brown, who had the entire Democratic Party establishment behind him.
And he?
He did win the primary.
And ultimately?
Governor Hogan, Republican, 74% approval rating. Well, so there are disruptive forces in all manner of local politics.
Well, we have in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where the Democratic Party establishment seemed to have rallied around Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam. And then another candidate came along who would be Tom Perriello. He is the Democratic candidate for governor in Virginia. He's a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing the 5th Congressional District, and he is our first guest in this broadcast. Congressman Perriello, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Tom Perriello, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojowamu.org. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream there, or send us a tweet at kojoshow. It's, I guess, the truth to say that some Virginia Democrats are not very happy about your candidacy. They thought they had a united front behind Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam and describe you as, well, a spoiler. Why did you decide to run?
Well, actually, the response from Democrats across the state has been incredible. It's just been a huge outpouring of support online, at our events, people donating online in small amounts, volunteering, etc. And I think
Did I get the spoiler stuff from?
Well, there's a difference, I think, between the party leadership and the party itself, which I think of as the voters. And I think when we try to make up our minds for the voters instead of listening to them, as was mentioned before, that can lead us into trouble. I think we win this election this year because we inspire our diverse and powerful coalition to show up and still win independence. And I think that's what I did twice in a much redder part of the state than the state as a whole. And I wouldn't have gotten in this race if I didn't think it gave Democrats the best chance to win this fall. And we have to do that, not just to push back against the politics of Trumpism or what we saw happen in North Carolina, but because this governor is going to oversee the redistricting that will define the politics of Virginia for the next generation. And I think we have a great opportunity to win it if we put together a passionate campaign.
Have you heard from the lieutenant governor or the governor since you announced?
Yes. I've talked to both. Ralph Northam is a class act. This is certainly something where we're hoping for a positive campaign. We've made a positive campaign pledge ourselves. The conversation was a very classy one, and I imagine we'll be crossing paths again soon here on the trail.
Has Ralph Northam been a good lieutenant governor?
I think he has, and I think Terry McAuliffe has been a good governor as well. There's a lot to point to in terms of economic growth. I think Terry's work on the governor's work on restoring voting rights has been historic, and I think there are many, many things that we can continue. I think that looking at what happened in November, it really was a game changer for a lot of people, both in terms of the political stakes and the political realities of how to win. And I think right now we can see from the last few statewide elections that we have to give our coalition, our base, a reason to show up, and we have to win independence. And in 2008, I came from 36% behind in a pretty red area to win that race and outperform the president, President Obama. And then in 2010, we outperformed the Democratic index by 10 points because we fought hard for health care, fought for climate change, fought for immigrant rights, and still won independence.
Well, you've kind of glossed over. You may have done well in that race, but you lost in 2010.
I think if you're actually looking at
I was looking at your letter to the Virginians that you sent, and it does point out all those things you just said, but you'd lost in 2010. Why did you lose in 2010?
Well, I think we saw where the Democratic brand was in that year. And the fact is, we didn't run away from that brand. We embraced it, and we still outperformed that Democratic brand by double digits. And again, that was in a deeply red part of the state. Now I'm running in the state as a whole, which is right down the middle, 50-50.
Excuse me, I apologize. You have a I'm not endorsing your resume, but you have a very good resume of things you've done.
Thank you.
And your background in the state and all of that. But the party did, let's go to the politics of this, the party did, Mark Herring, the Attorney General, decided not to run for governor. The Lieutenant Governor seemed to be headed to the nomination. What is it about Ralph Northam that you think you would be a better governor? I read this and I thought, well, this is kind of like Trump saying that Jeb Bush was low energy. Do you think Northam is low energy? I know you don't want to do a negative campaign, but you've got to draw a contrast. Is he low energy? What's the problem?
I think we'll leave it to the voters to decide. I think we hope to reintroduce myself across the state, and I think people are looking for someone who's a fighter, someone who has been willing to own and champion progressive causes.
Northam is not.
I'm just running my campaign, and I think what we've seen as a response is terrific. And I think people need to be a little less scared about these primaries. You know, there are real problems in the world, there are real crises, and I think we should put our best ideas forward. I'm pretty confident that when people see the campaigns, they're going to be excited about ours. And if that doesn't happen, then we'll unite and go forward in November.
Again, I appreciate your wanting to run a positive campaign. You said it in your letter, and I think that's a good thing. But in terms of drawing a contrast, when you stand before people, you can talk all the progressive things you want to talk about. Raising the minimum wage to $15 in Virginia, where they won't even raise it above the federal minimum wage now. You have to draw a contrast of why you would be better than Ralph Northam. Is there just one reason why you would be better? I don't mean for you to criticize him, but just a difference between you and Ralph Northam.
Well, I can tell you about myself, which is that I've been a leader who's produced results.
Okay,
and I think that one of the differences from a lot of folks, even some of those on the left, is that, you know, given a great speech doesn't do much for the poor, producing results does. And we were able to leverage over $500 million of investments into Central and Southside Virginia on broadband and education and clean energy projects because we were able to work with people regardless of their political affiliation. Some people think to do that, you got to distance yourself from your progressive values. I don't believe that's true. I think we should champion those and still be pragmatic.
We're talking with Tom Perriello. Tom Perriello is a Democratic candidate for governor of Virginia. He's a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing the 5th Congressional District. In case you're just joining us, you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Maryland Democratic Senator C. Anthony Mews and the police chief for Prince George's County, Maryland, Henry or Hank Stawinski. We'll be talking about the ongoing corruption scandal there and what's going on in the Maryland General Assembly. But back to former Congressman Tom Perriello, let me come at Tom's question a different way. What are the issues you plan on running on that you think may be different than the issues that Lieutenant Governor Northam has emphasized?
Well, we're going to focus on the importance of inclusive economic growth. We need good GDP in the state, but it can't leave anybody behind. And I think what we see too often right now is people are having trouble getting up that next rung of the ladder. We intentionally started our campaign last week in Danville, went through Charlottesville, and ended in Alexandria because we have very different parts of this state. In an area like Danville, there aren't enough jobs. In Northern Virginia, we have a lot of families working 3 or 4 jobs and still not able to put together enough for that down payment on a house. So I think ultimately, people are a little less interested in this guy versus that guy than who's helping us move up that ladder. I think inclusivity is also about the story we tell of Virginia. The defining moment for me in high school was watching the capital of the Confederacy elect the first black governor in all of the United States. We grew up with the oral tradition of Barbara Johns walking out of schools in Prince Edward along with the stories of Jefferson. That story of an expanding, inclusive dream across Virginia is a very simple one that I think people consider fair. And I think we don't want to concede those Virginia values to anyone. Virginia was a firewall against the kind of hateful politics we saw from Donald Trump. And I think right now we can embrace that inclusivity, both in terms of how the economy grows, but also in terms of how we embrace a very diverse
Virginia.
Is
there a distinction to be made between progressive Democrats and moderate Democrats? Is that what we're seeing here?
You know, I think right now there are some distinctions, but what's been useful in some ways is to see how much unity has been coming together. I think the party's more progressive than it used to be. I think it doesn't take its coalition for granted in the way that it has at some points in the past. And I think that makes us stronger as a party. And I think underneath that, it's a chance to say that ultimately, whatever color or creed you are, a big focus is going to be whether there are jobs out there that can help you move into the middle class or move up from there.
You know, I live in the district. I don't have any personal thing in this campaign, but Ralph Northam has sat right where you're sitting and said virtually the same thing with as much passion. And so I'm just trying to decide here on the politics hour, if you call him a statesman in your letter to the Virginians, I'm just looking for a compare and contrast one thing where you think he could have been more aggressive, not because you're
so
trying
why?
To tear him down.
You've
so
asked me this four times. Why do you think that it's important for us to be against each other?
Because I can cite the political boilerplate of wanting to make things better for everybody. But if you don't want to talk about your I just think one contrast would be good, that you have more experience, that you have more world experience, and Virginia's got a world economy, which you think you can bring to it. I mean, something that says you're different from him. Otherwise, it's just, you know, roll out boilerplate politics.
So let me actually turn the tables on you. I actually think you're getting a little bit wrong what the role of the reporter is and the politician.
This
I don't think the role
of
the politician should be to go negative and draw up contrast.
I think
that what reporters can do is look into my history and his history.
Okay.
You can find meaningful contrast in the rest. Okay. But I think we can focus on the positive
agenda.
Minimum
wage. What's the minimum wage?
Well, no. Let's stay with this for a while because Lisa in Washington wants to talk about this. Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I don't know who Lisa is.
Lisa, you're on the air.
A former Virginia voter, current D.C. voter, and I just wanted to say that I actually really respect Mr. Perriello's desire to make his affirmative case rather than a defensive one. Certainly, when we go out on job interviews, we don't know who the other candidates are, and we try to explain our qualifications in an affirmative sense so that others think that we are the most qualified or so that we make our case, and that, you know, certainly reporters or the media can, you know, take two candidates and compare their views. But I actually really respect and I find it very refreshing the idea that there's not, you know, a negative campaign and that Mr. Perriello is trying to make the case for himself rather than malign or demean anybody else.
But Lisa, then there's this. Here is an email we got from Mimi in Alexandria. I am very concerned that the Democrats will lose the governorship if we don't support the lieutenant governor. Tom can wait until 2021, to which you say what?
Well, he waited in 2013. He considered running once before, and he waited, and he supported Terry.
You're still a young man. Why can't you wait till 2021?
Yeah, I think the argument about people waiting their turn is not one that's really popular with most Democratic voters right now. I think that, you know, we do see a generational shift, and, you know, perhaps we can talk a little bit in those terms. There's a generation that came into politics in and around 2008 from a place of hope and a place of change. It was people of all different ages, but they were relatively new to politics, that Obama generation, and I was part of that. My background had been as a nonprofit executive before that, working on issues of economic inequality and racial justice and the rest. And there was a sense of moving into politics, in part with that very positive vision. And I think right now there is a real battle of ideas between that Obama generation and coalition that believes that progress is possible, that we can have an inclusive America and an inclusive Virginia. And I think the reaction we've seen from Trump, which I consider a very scary one, not just as a racial demagogue, but as someone undermining rule of law that has real implications for the economy, is a different way to go. And I think right now, if we cannot excite and inspire that generation of people who dared to believe that politics could be a positive place to be and has been brushed back from that, and just expect that those people are going to show up in November and vote, I think that's a losing strategy. And I think that's why we give the Democrats a much better chance to win.
Okay, let me just say this to the caller who called. Every question I asked, I was not trying to get him to malign or demean your opponent. I was asking for just what you said. You want a battle of ideas. I think it's reasonable to ask, what's one good idea that you disagree with or think you can do better than the current lieutenant governor, who you just mentioned generational. I don't think you're saying he's too old for the job, but maybe he has a different point of view. He's 57. But let me ask you about a specific issue. Minimum wage. What's the federal minimum wage now?
$7.25.
Right. And in Virginia, it's?
$7.25.
How are you going to get a Republican legislature to change the, you, as you said in your letter to Virginians, you want to go to $15, just like the District of Columbia has done. How would you do that?
So I think we have a few steps to get there, and I think we want to be honest with voters about two things. One, what we aspire to, what we want to get to, and two, what we can get done. And I think that what we have to understand is we need an economy where somebody who is working full-time is not in poverty. And right now, the second biggest employer in the state is Walmart. They're paying that minimum wage. And what does that mean? It means we're picking, we're doing public subsidies for that worker.
Walmart's paying minimum wage? I thought they went up to $10. Maybe I'm wrong.
And through Fight for 15, I think we've seen working with businesses to try to create an environment and where we get there. And I think most businesses agree with that. What all the evidence has shown over the last few years is that growth does not trickle down from the top. It's about the purchasing power of the working and middle class. When the middle class has disposable income, when the working class does, we see more growth in our communities. So these are pro-growth strategies, and we need to figure out the way to get there.
So some how would you, compared can your I, current, just one more, I apologize. So to get to 15, you would do it like Maryland, or the counties in Maryland, D.C. You would do it on a graduated scale to move it up to 15 so businesses can adjust. But how that would do, you'd work out a little bit later.
That's right. I think we can know where we're trying to get to. And I think the other thing I just want to mention on this, that because it is going to be one of the biggest issues in this race, is the issue of the redistricting map in Virginia. We had a radical redistricting map come in that Ed Gillespie, who's the Republican candidate, to try to make sure that the Virginia legislature reflects his clients in D.C. instead of our citizens. And you don't get the Mark Warner kind of compromises that you saw a decade ago, where you had Republicans who would cross over, you could make the investments in a balanced budget and public education. And that's nothing against Governor McAuliffe, who has worked harder than any human being could imagine to push for those things, and he's accomplished a lot. But too many of the things that are going to build inclusive economic growth over the next 10 years are blocked by that legislature, and that's one of the things we're going to have to address.
A lot of Virginians want to speak with you. We'll start with Bruce in Fairfax. Bruce, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Kojo, and good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Bruce.
Hi, my question is, you had the endorsement of the NRA when you ran for Congress, and do you expect to seek the NRA endorsement again?
Definitely not. You know, I feel less like I've left the NRA than that they've left me, but I fought very hard for the Manchin-Toomey sensible common sense gun reform. I helped run a national advocacy group that was one of the leaders in pushing for common sense gun reform. You know, when I grew up, the NRA was at my Boy Scout and YMCA camps with target practice and gun safety and protecting wilderness. And now they've really become a nut job extremist organization, as I've called them before, that is much more interested in representing the gun makers than responsible gun owners. I do believe the Second Amendment protects people's right to bear arms. And I think that's consistent with moves towards common sense gun reform that I have actively advocated for at the national level.
Are you an Eagle Scout? You are, aren't you?
I am an Eagle Scout.
Is there a badge? I didn't do that well in Scouts, but, you know, I'm in the media, so. But was there a badge for firearms? I think I remember a firearms badge.
We definitely went through the training. I don't know that I got the badge. I didn't sit still that well, so the marksmanship wasn't always terrific. But, you know, it was something that was, you know, pretty regular part of life, and I think we've got to figure out how to distinguish between our sportsman tradition and responsible gun ownership this sort of stupidity. And, you know, we called out Corey Stewart the other day doing the AR-15 raffle, which does nothing but make responsible gun owners look bad.
Do you think he's going to be the Republican? Who do you think is going to win the Republican thing? Ed Gillespie, you mentioned already. Corey Stewart, a couple other people have gotten in.
Oh, it's hard to know who to hope for in that routine. I kind of hope it's Gillespie. But
Mason Dixon just came out with a poll that said Ed Gillespie leads you by 45-36, but a lot of that is people don't quite know you yet.
Right. That's it's pretty sad for Gillespie when he's already run statewide and he's been running for several years and he's still only at that mark. And, you know, here you have one of the biggest D.C. corporate lobbyists trying to come into Virginia and bring the most corrupt, you know, politics of this state, of this area, into our state, literally wrote the K Street strategy about how to sell out the American middle class to the highest bidder. And now he wants to come in and try to be like a middle of the road, aw shucks guy in Virginia.
So much Virginians. For the politics of positive campaigning. He just trashed Gillespie.
Some have compared your current campaign.
And I'm sure he's a nice guy, too. I want to be clear about that. I'm just talking about.
Some have compared your current campaign theme to the populism of Bernie Sanders. And we got an email from Boyd who says, please ask Tom if he will be reaching out to Sanders voters in Virginia. I think he will need them to win, as he will not get the endorsements that Northam already has. How will he win over the progressive wing of the party?
Hey, we're reaching out to all the Democrats out there, the Bernie supporters, the Hillary supporters, people who were for Gary Johnson. I don't care if you're with the Democratic Party, and we want independents and Republicans, too. I don't think there's any question that Bernie Sanders ignited an enormous enthusiasm among part of our coalition that has to show up at elections. And that includes young voters and others. And I think that, we're eager to make sure people are engaged in this campaign. There was such a sort of kick in the gut for so many people when this election result came out. But we used to have a phrase in my organizing days called crisitunities, that a crisis is an opportunity. And I think what I've seen at the Democratic events I've gone to, in Alexandria, Arlington, but also further south, is record numbers. You see record numbers of people showing up at Democratic events, both ours and in general. And what we need to do is embrace that full breadth and turn that generation of energy into a group that takes ownership over Virginia politics.
What's your budget? I realize it can change, but Virginia is wide open. Anybody can give you any amounts of money. Will you put personal money in? What's your general budget as you start this campaign? Do you think it'll take, knowing that you've got well-funded Republican opponents, if you get the nomination?
Well, we don't have the budget yet, but, we put together that launch in 10 days because I was stuck under the Hatch Act until Christmas Eve, still trying to negotiate a peace deal as part of the Obama administration over in the Congo. And in 10 days, we put together a pretty impressive launch, I think, in terms of the response we got and covering the whole state. And we did a lot of that with volunteer energy, super qualified people who gave up their vacations over the holidays because they believe in me and they believe in this campaign. And now around that volunteer energy, we're going to build a fully professional core of mostly Virginia team. And I think within that, we'll be looking at budget questions and all sorts of other things that are probably not as exciting for the readers. But it's a serious, this
well,
is a serious
Well, I'm glad you mentioned budget questions, because the General Assembly just got underway this week. Top issues include the $1 billion budget shortfall, Metro Safety Commission approval, health and gun-related bills. But first and foremost, how do you recommend closing that budget gap? And how would you be able to work with the people on the other side of the aisle?
Well, I think we had a history of that in the 5th District of having to work across the aisle. I know Governor McAuliffe has been working hard to do so. I thought he put together a great coalition to try to support the Medicaid expansion over the last few years that had been part of Obamacare that I had supported in Congress. And I still can't believe that $8 billion of free federal funding was rejected by the Republicans in the legislature that not only would have helped some of the most vulnerable Virginians, but by rejecting it immediately sent up premiums for middle-class voters and risked the stability of hospitals and employment in many rural counties. And these aren't, again, the kind of Republicans we used to get in the Warner era that would cross the aisle for common-sense solutions. Because of this radical redistricting map, instead what we have is people who are only worried about that primary challenge. So they're not being pragmatic. They're not being pro-business and pro-growth. So part of it is that we do have to hand the legislature back to the people with an honest map. But we're going on a listening tour here over the next few weeks, and I think we'll be looking at priorities from the voters there, and there's no better reflection of your priorities than your budget.
That is a big national Democratic issue, in that you've lost so many city, county, state, governor offices and all that, and you've got to work from grassroots up to get them back. Now, you just said you're going to go on a listening tour. You've been to Danville, you've been to Alexandria, you've been to Richmond. Where's the listening tour going to take you?
Oh, we're going to cover the whole state. I think anyone who knows me from the Congress days or the nonprofit days knows that no one's going to outwork us.
I apologize. Do you already have an itinerary set? We can go to a website and see it?
It's not posted yet.
I'm pushing your campaign here.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. People can go to Tom for Virginia, tomforvirginia.com.
Okay, good.
We're launching in Norfolk, I believe, on Monday.
Ooh.
We'll be down in Richmond this weekend for some of the rallies.
Where's Ralph Northam from?
He is from that area, and again, a great public servant, and we're going to be crisscrossing the whole state.
Running out of time very quickly, but you did mention that you were working on a deal in the Congo. The United States has a reputation in the Congo dating back to 1960 of having supported the Belgians when they ousted Lumumba, having supported the brutal dictator who ran the country for so many years. But you were recently involved in trying to negotiate a deal with the current president, Joseph Kabila, who apparently wanted to stay on. You were apparently successful in negotiating democratic elections coming in 2017. But I am interested in what is the reputation of the United States in the Congo at this point, given our history, especially since we are so upset about Russia interfering in our election, when in fact we had been doing things like that in the Congo in the past.
Well, one of the incredible things about doing this job for President Obama was that it was a case where the people overwhelmingly supported our policy, which is not always true. The Congolese people are incredibly proud of their constitution. They're proud that they were able to end the civil war and have a shot at peace. And the constitution said that President Kabila needed to leave power. President Obama gave a soaring speech in Addis Ababa saying that it's time for term limits to be respected and that Africa needs strong institutions, not strong men. And that's probably been the single most popular piece of his Africa policy with the African people, though not necessarily with all the African leaders, as you can imagine. So in the DRC case, it was a very popular position. It was an interesting case where also the Catholic bishops were absolutely central. So it was one of those opportunities where both my church and my country were on the right side of something in Africa.
You were running back and forth to the Vatican at one point.
Yes. But this is also, I think, what I've tried to do in general is be a problem solver. And I think what is key to that, I'd never been to the Great Lakes region, but you go and listen. And people are much smarter than the leaders give them credit for. And when you actually bother to listen and figure out leverage and bring people together, you can solve problems.
Hence the listening tour in Virginia, even as we speak. I'm afraid we are out of time. Tom Perriello is a Democrat. Perriello is a Democratic candidate for the governor of Virginia. He's a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives representing the 5th Congressional District. A lot of people want to talk to you, so you'll be doing a lot of listening. Thank you very much for joining
us. Send them to tomforvirginia.com.
Later in the broadcast, or very shortly, we'll be joined by Maryland State Senator C. Anthony Muse and Hank Stawinski III, who is the chief of police for Prince George's County, Maryland. But Tom Sherwood, just briefly, I wanted to talk about the sudden, unexpected removal of the commanding general of the D.C. National Guard. Major General Errol R. Schwartz is going to be removed at 12:01 p.m. on Inauguration Day, which is right immediately after the new president is sworn in. I have to say that Major General Schwartz happens to hail from my own native country, Guyana.
And that's probably why you bring this up.
No, actually, of course.
You know, I got to see him in December. I went over to the armory where they have this great 60-foot-long, 40-foot-wide map of the downtown where they do tabletop exercises of what's going to happen. And I talked to General Schwartz there, but, you know, he's been the commander. There's no understanding yet of why he's been given this peremptory, you're out as of 12:01. He was appointed by President Bush. Now, the district is different than the states where the governors appoint the heads of the National Guard. In the district, it's a presidential appointment, just like our judges. And he was appointed by George Bush in 2005, and then he was reappointed by President Obama. And it is the president's choice for him to serve. And as he said, that he will send his men out to do duty on an Arbor
Day. But when they come back,
he will not be there to welcome them back. It's kind of sad. He's a very nice man. I know of no criticisms of him. And I'm anxiously hoping we find out why this was a decision to do this.
Well, joining us now in studio is Henry Stawinski III. He is the chief of police for Prince George's County, Maryland. Chief Stawinski, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you in person.
And joining us by phone is C. Anthony Muse. He's a Maryland state senator. He's a Democrat representing District 26 in Prince George's County. Senator Muse, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon to both of you, my friends. Good to be here.
If you have questions, give us a call, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org.
I was just going to say, Senator Muse, did you Metro not, I mean, did it break down, the Green Line or something break down? You couldn't get in to come see us here in the studio?
I wish we could have. Being here in Annapolis, it's quite a haul from here to there.
Former Prince George's delegate Will Campos pleaded guilty in connection with a bribery and corruption scandal involving the Prince George's Liquor Board last week. The U.S. Attorney's Office for Maryland had said that more than one elected official was under investigation. That led to rampant speculation. And just before the start of the General Assembly session this week, Delegate Michael Vaughn resigned. We don't know yet if his resignation is related to the case, but his name had been part of that speculation. Can you give us any more information at this point? Do you know anything more?
No, the only thing that I know is what I've been reading, and, you know, there are rumors that are flying around about it. I don't know how many, but it will certainly be a few compared to the more than 150 elected officials in terms of municipalities and all offices that we hold in our county. It's a shame that that's happened. I am told that it is ongoing. I am told that there are others who may be involved. But again, I do disagree with some who say it's a culture of corruption. It really isn't. We have over a million good citizens, and I work with hard-working elected officials, over 150 of them. And if a few decide to break the law, they will pay, and we've got to now look ahead to how we can make sure that this does not happen again.
Go ahead, please.
Senator, the U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein has the support of the governor, the Republican governor, the state the senators and all of that. I was just, how do you feel as an elected official when the prosecutor in various papers or an interview says that there are other elected officials who may be caught up in this web of wrongdoing? If I were an elected official in Prince George's County, and I certainly would have done nothing wrong, I'd be screaming my head off that a cloud has been cast over the entire county.
I agree with you. I agree that a cloud has been cast over the county. I also agree it's not the first time, and unfortunately, we have a number of laws that are in place dealing with conflict of interest and ethics reform. If someone chooses to break the law, if there are three or four or five who chooses to break the law, you still have the more than 140 who are left who are hardworking men and women, ordinary men and women who abide by the law and do all that they can. It makes me feel bad because these are persons that we have worked with. These are persons, some, and again, I don't know that much to comment on who's innocent, who's guilty. We're all innocent until proven guilty in our country, but should that be the case, then it is wrong, and we should be also standing with the prosecutor and anyone else to say, this is not our county, and this is not what we condone, and we're going to continue to work to make sure this does not happen.
You announced Wednesday that you'll introduce a bill that would revamp the structure of the liquor board and the way licenses to sell alcohol are awarded. How would that work?
That is correct. First of all, we have five commissioners who represent eight districts. I introduced a bill some time ago that would give one commissioner to each district so that all the voices are heard, and maybe this would not happen. I was the only one who voted against the Sunday liquor sale. I understood what they were trying to do with that bill. They were trying to say, should we be a Sunday liquor county in terms of selling liquor or not? There was a compromise that said, well, we'll give out 100 licenses in instead. I did not agree with that because I think it sets you up for persons to have to bid and compete, and that's not the way we want it to do. So I'm going to put a bill in that will say either it's Sunday sales for all or Sunday sales for none, but senators, and no matter who we are, holding on to licenses, trying to bargain with persons, it really sets us up. I want to repeal that Sunday liquor license. We should not have 100 licenses only for a county with over 600 businesses. That really should not be done. But then I want to set up a task force to study how other jurisdictions are doing it. Ours is outdated, it's antiquated, and it was back in the day when senators were seen as the controllers of the county. We're not. We're public servants. And if you don't put layers of checks and balances in place, then this is not going to, then what we're looking for and setting ourselves up for is more persons who have a propensity to do this to actually be able to get away with it, and that tarnishes our county.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Now, are these members of the board actually appointed by the governor of the state? Did I read that correctly?
They are only appointed by the governor with the consent of, with the names being sent up by the senators. So senators will send up names to the governor, and each district sends up names. As it is now, there are three districts where the five commissioners are come from. I don't have a commissioner in my district. Other districts do not.
Why should the governor appoint county liquor control? I mean, why? In Arundel and all the other counties, I know, but it seems to me that could be part of your reform effort is to have it controlled in the county itself.
It should be controlled in the county. There should be layers of ways in which it's regulated. You're right. The governor then is put on the spot because he's got to appoint the names that we send up to the governor. But again, when there's no accountability as to how those names are selected, if it's no sense of do you have one from each senatorial district so that those persons in that district know that I'm held accountable and I can't be held accountable if I don't even have a voice on that commission, which I do not. And again, I did not vote for this bill because I did not think it was a way to address the issue. Do you want Sunday sales in our county or not? That was the issue, and it led to all of this.
One more question.
Have you spoken either to Will Campos or Michael Vaughn, the delegate who resigned on the hour of the legislature convening, or have you just tried to have to step back from them until the sky is clear?
Well, no, I actually serve in the Senate, and so I don't really have the 141 of them. I know them. I know of them. I haven't worked with them on any – and probably Delegate Vaughn, because he's a counterpart in terms of working with him on some issues, but I don't know them that well. I have not reached out to them.
Has this been a major distraction in the General Assembly as the session gets underway?
I would say it's been a distraction, and that it is because, again, you know, unfortunately, you don't know when the prosecutor will say in the middle of our session, here we have another indictment, and we're trying to get the people's work done. And so we're hoping that he will bring this to a quick resolution so that we know how we're moving forward, who is going to. Right now we have to replace a Vaughn, and so that's another process altogether. If we've got to do this two or three or four times, it will become a major distraction, but it's only, I guess, a major distraction. And as he said, if you've done wrong, come forward. If not, we're coming after you. I think those are the persons for whom it's a major distraction.
Senator Muse, thank you for joining us.
I thank you so very much. And to my police chief, he's my friend, and I look forward to talking to you. Thank you so very much.
He's about to have a real hard time here. C. Anthony Muse is a Maryland state senator. He's a Democrat representing District 26 in Prince George's County. Once again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Senator.
Also in studio with us is Hank Stawinski, III. He's the chief of police for Prince George's County, Maryland. If you have any questions at all about policing in Prince George's County, call now, 800-433-8850. Chief Stawinski, the U.S. Attorney's Office for Maryland and the FBI have been pursuing these charges. What has been the role of the police, of the Prince George's Police Department in this investigation?
So we've been an active participant in this investigation for the past few years. Investigators from the Office of the Chief, who are tasked with looking into public corruption issues, have been part of this investigation alongside case agents from the FBI, agents from the Internal Revenue Service, and then obviously under the leadership of Mr. Rosenstein, the United States Attorney.
You have, is it your Bureau of Investigations? Who are the officers within your, you have like 2,000 or 2,300 people in your police force?
That's right, Tom, but we do have a particular group that is tasked with public corruption issues.
What is that squad called?
So that's the public corruption team.
Oh, that's...
And those operate out of the Office of the Chief that was begun by my predecessor in office, Chief McGaw, that continues under my tenure. And then they collaborate with the FBI primarily. And this is one unfortunate set of circumstances, but there are other instances that those detectives are tasked with looking into in collaboration with federal officials.
So when the liquor stores are raided, it's in this case, I think two liquor stores are raided, is that correct? Your officers are there not only as part of the investigation, but also for the public safety and control of the alleged crime scene.
So those investigators are primarily tasked with the investigation, the search warrant, all of the things that would go along with that raid, but then you'll have members of our patrol and emergency services team providing safety for the public in that circumstance.
You're a leader of the county. What, without getting into any individual persons, that people have pled guilty or charged or might be charged, the county has worked hard. Certainly the county executive, Sharon Baker, after the Jack Johnson embarrassments. You've got the casino there. You're trying to really, as I said last week, put big boy pants on and show that the county has gone much farther along. You're trying to get the FBI to come and headquarter itself in your county. What is your, as the person who's been on the police force, I think, since 1992?
Yes, sir.
Is that correct? What do you think of the image as a setback to the county of what's happening now?
Well, I will gently disagree with that, and I've
that
not
was a
just,
lot. Sorry, go ahead.
You're just lucky it's gentle.
I'm not just a long-serving police officer in Prince George County, but I was born and raised there.
You live there. You're
my
native
whole
of.
Life. And raising
Not
my daughter
yet.
There now. So my response to that is that this county is becoming very sophisticated very rapidly. And you note a lot of the instances where we've demonstrated our ability to open a $1.4 billion casino to attract the attention of those who would put the FBI headquarters here. That's a first hurdle,
right,
is to be in competition for that. And to respond, there are, as Senator Muse mentioned, some people who have advantaged themselves by virtue of their political office. But we have a mechanism and a team who is investigating that, and we are looking not just there but in other corners of the county for graft and corruption. It is as important to us to police those matters as it is to police violent crime, property crime. In the lead-up, I think there was a statistic from NHTSA about an increase in fatal collisions.
NHTSA.
National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And they are experiencing an increase in those fatal collisions. You've seen a one-third reduction in fatal collisions in Prince George's County. But my point is that we are equally concerned with all of these issues, and what it comes back to is preserving the integrity of our institutions,
right,
and ensuring the public trust.
Speaking of the public trust, this past year there were a number of incidents involving Prince George's County public schools and sexual abuse cases. What kind of challenge has that been for you, and how is the law enforcement community working with the school system to prevent and to address cases like that?
So prior to walking in with you gentlemen, I was on the phone with the superintendent, Kevin Maxwell. We have an issue right now that we're working in conjunction with him on. And those conversations.
Can you tell us what that issue is?
There's an incident occurring right now at Suitland High School.
Oh,
it is contained, it's under control, and it is not an active shooter situation, as some had reported.
Okay.
So
good.
That Thank said, you. No, you're more than welcome, Tom. That said, this has become a daily, weekly conversation for myself and Dr. Maxwell as we look at the structures that did not lead to timely reporting, did not lead to full notification across all the spectrum of county services to include social services in some instances. And our work is to look at those structures and improve them so that when a parent or a child raises a concern, that is acted upon quickly.
The speed of information these days, whether it's internet, social media, any of that, and what you guys need to know and how fast you need to know it, it's just dramatically different from just a few years ago.
It's funny you say that because I was having a conversation just the other day with some of my friends at the FBI about the tenure of Chief Mitchell. And the reality is that the role of the police chief and the role of the police in society has transformed almost completely in these intervening years. And to your point, mm-hmm. that timely information matters, particularly to me, because our goal, once we learn of that, is to immediately intervene and ensure that further harm doesn't occur. But Kevin Maxwell is equally invested in that. And to go back to some of the broader topics we were discussing, this is one of the things that Mr. Baker made a point of standing up at the beginning of his administration, manifested itself as the Office of Ethics and Accountability run by Robin Barnshell. And there's another mechanism in conjunction with, to your comment about the police department, we've become very sophisticated as well. Jen Donlan has joined our team to ensure that we provide quick, accurate information to the public. A gentleman by the name of Stephen Whitted has joined to help us with legal matters. But I want to go back to one of the hires that Chief McGaw made early in his tenure, but I recruited and brought to the department on his behalf, Carlos Acosta, our Inspector General. Again, another integrity assurance mechanism so that these things can't persist.
On to body cameras. Prince George's is considering body cameras for police. It's my understanding the first phase is getting underway now. Not a pilot program, but an initial six-month study period. Why is Prince George's only studying body cameras at this point when many police departments, including right next door in the districts, have rolled out body cameras as a key part of ensuring transparency and accountability?
Well, Kojo, I'm happy to correct the record on that point. in Prince George's County, we are on our third generation of full deployment of in-car cameras. And there are other jurisdictions throughout the region, throughout the country, who have different postures with respect to in-car cameras. But again, we went from the VHS tape to the CD to now the digital system. And what we've done is, it's not a study. We're implementing body cameras, but we're doing it in such a way as to coordinate them with the in-car camera. So we're not going to take the in-car cameras out. We're going to add the body camera. That's a technical issue, so that that feed is accessible. And we have one of the biggest challenges across the country in terms of cameras in general is the capacity to store the video. So it's taken us some time to do that. But this initial implementation will grow. And it's not a study. We did do a study 2 years ago when we were looking at different systems and different capacities. But we found a system that will integrate to our in-car camera system and allow us to have not just the in-car but the body camera. And that will be our posture going forward.
And when do you think you'll have essentially most of the patrol officers having body cameras all in place?
So in order to make certain that we're doing it well and we produce a good product for the public and for our officials who have oversight, we're doing a implementation of 6 months in conjunction with the Department of Sociology at University of Maryland. So we're providing them data points on how that is deployed, and then we're going to have a control group, and we're going to look at differences in reaction and differences in response, and then we're going to make better choices going forward about where we deploy them.
So maybe in the next year or so, if you're not a precise... Well,
they'll be out on the streets here very shortly, and then we'll grow from there.
Can I ask about homicides? Not yet. Homicides?
Let's talk with Jordan in Washington, D.C. Jordan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. My name is Jordan Malka, and I work at an immigration legal aid service provider in Baltimore. So we have a lot of clients in PG County, and I just wanted how is PG County's police department responding to some of the MS-13 and 18th Street gangs, the Central American gangs, and some of the latest incidents?
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, Kojo. At the beginning of my tenure as police chief, I appointed specific responsibilities to the deputy chiefs. The deputy chief, going back to something Tom mentioned, for our Bureau of Investigation is and remains responsible for a subset which deals specifically with gang issues, MS-13 and 18th Street. We have collaborated with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and we sent the leader of our gang group to El Salvador on a fact-finding mission so they could learn more about the nature of that conflict. And we're working very diligently to understand what's actually motivating them, because what we're seeing is an evolution into more of a corporate structure where you have recruiting, you have revenue, you have enforcement, as opposed to a less organized posture. And as we understand that better, we're able to better interrupt their plans. And one of our main concerns is with respect to their effort to recruit. And how can we interrupt that? How can we work with the community and parents to ensure that they don't have an appealing message for young people?
And how do they fund themselves? Do they engage in drug distribution? What is the financial backing for something like MS-13?
Well, as with organized crime throughout time, there's prostitution, there's drugs, there's enforcement, there is some trade in alcohol, illicit bars or beer houses, as they're referred to. Mm. They have a number of revenue streams, but the county has done a good job in standing up regulatory structures so that some of those businesses that they used to routinely extort, they don't have that opportunity any longer. And that's where the key is not always law enforcement, but sometimes law enforcement in conjunction with good regulatory structures.
The casino's been open for just over a month. What associated crimes have been occurring around there? Not the people misbehaving inside. There's only been a few of those. But has there been any significant change in either burglaries or robberies, or how's it been for the first month?
No significant change, but I will say that we're very early in this process, and we're monitoring that carefully. The largest effort that we have engaged in terms of issues associated with the casino, beyond traffic.
Drunk driving.
Beyond traffic, yes, sir.
We need to get into that
at
this moment.
He said it was going to be tough. Beyond traffic is actually helping people who have self-barred themselves, and then there's a civil citation associated with that. So people say, I shouldn't be in the casino, and then MGM finds them as they're trying to gain entry to the casino floor. And in some instances, again, the majority of things we've done is to help people control their habit, and then we have issued some civil citations based on their voluntary banning.
Prostitution is a thing that comes around casinos, too, but again, we're just too new, too early into the process.
Well, I won't speak very much about it, but we have a pretty sophisticated effort that we're working through now, and we are ensuring that that community doesn't have the opportunity to root in the MGM.
Baltimore officials announced an agreement this week with the Justice Department to revamp the city's police department, and some disturbing practices that came to light this in the wake of the Freddie Gray case that sparked riots in the city. Prince George's obviously is not Baltimore, but what are police departments like yours doing to ensure that police follow proper conduct?
So, Kojo, that's a great question. That comes back to something we've been doing for more than a dozen years. As many in our community know and the greater area know, Prince George's County was subject to a memorandum of agreement and a consent decree. I had the opportunity under then Chief High to actually be responsible with the gentleman I appointed assistant chief and a now retired major to completely overhaul and rewrite our policy system and to bring our policies into line with national best practices. All of those components of that process were incorporated into policy. And then coming back to those questions at the beginning about structures, structures really help an organization to function properly, and we've kept those structures in place. So it's not about what we're doing today in response to what we hear from Baltimore or what we hear today in terms of Ms. Lynch's findings in with respect to Chicago, but it's what we've been doing all along and ensuring that our policies are timely. And then it comes back to the Office of the Inspector General with Mr. Acosta to ensure that not only are those things proper from a policy perspective, but that use of force incidents are reviewed and found to be proper, that reporting is accurate, and that we understand fundamentally the views of our community on how we're providing this service, and that comes back to my obligations.
We only have about a minute left.
Very quickly, had 98 homicides in Prince George's County. That was up or down from the previous year?
That was up.
That was up. You have said that you think marijuana is one of the causing problems with that. But others would say in the district it's legal, then homicides are down. Virginia doesn't have legal marijuana. There are not a lot of homicides. Why is marijuana the boogeyman here?
Well, I won't say it's the boogeyman, but I will say that the public expects us to understand fundamentally what's motivating this. And we do not have legal marijuana. We have decriminalized marijuana. So the substance itself is still contraband. And what's driving that is
We've got about 20 seconds.
I'm sorry. Well, what's driving it very briefly is not the end user. It's the individuals who want to control the trade in that contraband substance, and they're willing to do violence to control that
substance.
Hank Stawinski III is the Chief of Police for Prince George's County, Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's it for the show today. Remember that both Maryland and Virginia started their legislative sessions this past week. For more on the top debates we'll be following out of Annapolis and Richmond, be sure to visit kojoshow.org/blog, where we have a rundown of each state's brewing battles. Enjoy the holiday weekend, and be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon on the day Martin Luther King's birthday is commemorated for, among other reasons, the 1963 March on Washington. We'll discuss whether protests should be fun and why some think pink hats and funny signs could undermine a serious message at the Women's March on Washington. Tom Sherwood, you have a great weekend.
I will. Demonstrations should have all people involved, whether they're funny or serious.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Elizabeth Weinstein, Ruth Tam, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.